Welcome to Thanks for Sharing, the podcast where we explore all things recovery, healing, and relationship. I'm John T.
And I'm Jackie P.
This is episode 9, What Addicts Should Know About Their Spouses. So we decided to insert a couple episodes here in this series about attachment, about addicts understanding what their spouses go through, and our next episode is going to be what spouses need to understand about what their addict is going through.
Right.
Because so much of this gets to the heart of attachment and gets to the heart of attachment wounds.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the most important things for addicts to understand, is that their addiction and their acting out, even if it's been secret for years and it feels like there wasn't impact until the spouse knew about it, this has been undermining the attachment the whole time.
Right.
And that kind of attachment wound has real repercussions. It's not something that we just jump up from. Like, that really turns the world upside down.
Yeah. Well, I think it's one of those, you know, sometimes when I am talking to people, I'll ask them this question, you know, would you rather be caught or would you rather be betrayed? And most people are saying, well, I'd rather be caught. I'd rather neither. But I'd rather be caught, because the person who's caught has an awareness of what's happening.
Yeah.
And the one who's betrayed, you know, I mean, with some of our partners, they may have known, but they didn't know the depth, or they didn't know how wide the addiction was, how massive the acting out behaviors were. And so, you know, they really were caught unaware, which really has this impact. And I think sometimes in our field as therapists, we can tend to minimize the impact that it is having on the partner.
Right.
As really being this relational trauma.
You know, even in couples that I've seen, they go into a marriage, for example, and both parties know that there's addiction, but they really don't know what living with an addict means.
Mm-hmm.
And they really don't know what that's like. They have the same relational and attachment trauma as somebody who didn't know for 2 decades.
Right.
In a marriage. I think it really comes down to what that experience is and those visceral feelings of safety that can't be there.
Yeah.
When addiction
and
is
present. I think for a lot of partners, there's this feeling of, you know, I'm sleeping with a stranger.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, that is really unraveling for us at a core level, to look at and say, okay, here's this person that I'm vulnerable with, that I'm really open with, and all of a sudden I'm looking at them and I don't know who they are.
So if we were to try to get into the shoes of a partner that's experiencing that kind of reality collapse, like, what is it like to walk a mile in their shoes? What is it like to live a day as a partner that's having that reality
collapse? That's what we want to talk about today, just some things to kind of help, you know, the addict spouse be able to look at and say, okay, here's what's going on for them. Because otherwise they're going to really misread some of that and feel like, wow, you're really cold, or you're really mean and distant. And that's usually not what's going on.
And addicts are already really good at personalizing all of that. So hopefully as we give you some of that perspective and talk about some of that experience, not that it moves to this place of I don't care, but you can kind of have a place to put this and understand why it would look that way.
Right. You can start to make sense of why they might be doing what they're doing.
Yeah. So I want to start with that idea of, like, that feeling of I've married a complete stranger.
Okay.
I think that the concept of reality collapse is really important for addicts to understand about their spouses. We have heard from people before, they've said, when I know that there's relapse going on, I could walk outside and you could tell me the sky is blue and I would question. Like,
right.
I know I'm seeing a blue sky, but I don't really know if, I don't know what's real.
Or kind of that, like, I know what blue means to me, but when you say the word blue, I don't know if we're talking about the same thing. Like, it's that unnerving, that, like, really some basic things that we operate on, like, this is the color blue, all of a sudden we start to question all of that.
So like, in the relationship, there's that basic operational understanding of, although we may not get along all the time, I don't feel like you're against me. That goes out the window.
Right.
And there's a real question of, do you really care about me? Do you really love me? Are you really here for me?
Well, and another thing that goes out the window is all of these moments in the relationship that we maybe have looked back on and thought, oh, that was such a tender moment, or this was such a fun moment, or this was such a great moment. When the partner starts to see that the addiction was weaved into all of that, mm-hmm. they want to throw all of it out.
Yeah.
You know, that none of that was real. And they can't understand how this moment that really meant a lot to me is still real, even though all of this other stuff was going on in our lives at that time that I didn't know about.
And as the addicted spouse, here's my tip of the day. Do not try to explain how that works.
Like, right.
Don't talk about it. Accept that that's the reality.
Yeah.
That it is a lot more complicated than, no, that was a time I was really there for you.
Mm-hmm.
Be aware that as your addiction comes out, your spouse has learned that you've been deceiving them.
Right.
So that's another part of the reality collapse is they're going to have a really hard time, and rightly so, trusting anything that mm-hmm. you have to say. So going into explanations, going into reassurances actually tends to widen that reality collapse rather than help it.
Yeah. Well, and because I think that is a trauma response where we go to some real extreme thinking.
Yeah.
And so that's something they may be able to come, the partner may be able to come back to at a later date and accept that moment there was authentic connection happening, even though the previous week this affair had happened or this acting out behavior had happened. But kind of right when it's all unraveling and they're watching their life fracture into millions of pieces, this, you know, coming in and saying, well, wait, no, that was real. And I did care about you and I do still love you. That doesn't really fit into their extreme thinking.
Right. And in a trauma response, we can see a big disconnect between what the body and the brain are experiencing. And mm-hmm. that doesn't mean that the brain's on the side of, okay, I can see that things are real and the body's saying this is unsafe. It flip-flops
yep.
all the time. Like
yep.
there's not really a stable place to go back to. And that's something that, trained therapists will help spouses to do early on is to mm-hmm. get back in touch with their intuition
mm-hmm.
and to be able to reconcile the body with the brain and start seeing things as they are. But until that work is able to happen and that stability is able to start, it's really hard for a spouse to know what's real and what's not.
Right. And for the addict, what that's going to look like is you're going to get a lot of mixed messages.
Yes.
You know, one week they may be saying, I really just want to spend time with you. I need you close to me. And the next week it's like, get away from me. I don't want to even look at you.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can try as therapists to help kind of minimize some of those mixed messages. But when we start to look at, you know, what's happening in the nervous system, what's happening in the brain, some of that is just going to happen. Like
yeah.
we can't make it not happen.
I mean, that is attachment trauma. The bottom, the safety falls out and
yeah.
there's nothing solid to rely on,
right.
nothing solid to go back to.
And at that point, the brain is responding from this danger place.
Yeah.
And we're going to have to do some of the writing out and hopefully, you know, minimize some of the impact of that. But some of that, like we can't just say to the brain, hey, you're not in danger, because the brain knows it's in danger.
Yeah. And I think for the addict, their trauma response to that trauma response is to do a lot of reassuring and a lot of talking. I love when we were at the modules and Carnes would talk about our job as a therapist is to be the master of the obvious.
Yeah.
And one of his master of the obvious quotes is that you earn trust by doing what you say you would do over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Notice that the focus there is on doing,
right.
not on saying.
Not on saying.
And so as the addicted spouse see your partner in this trauma response free fall, get focused on your own integrity, get focused on your own program.
Yeah.
Because you need to build some reserves of being able to do what you say you would do over and over again if there's going to be any kind of trusting attachment again mm-hmm. in the future.
And that's, I think sometimes, you know, I've worked with addicts before who will say, I don't want to do all of this hard work. And then at the end of it all, have them say, well, I still don't trust you. And while I understand that, you know, one of the things that I will often say is you don't have control over whether or not they give you trust again.
Right.
Like that's something you have to surrender, because the reality of it is none of us have control over whether somebody chooses to give us trust or refuses to give us trust. What we do have control over is, do I act in trustworthy ways?
And also along those lines, you have not walked in your spouse's shoes. Right. You do not know what pre-existing hurts there might be mm-hmm. there. So you really don't know the depth of the hurt
right.
on this. So I think that brings me to another important point in knowing what your spouse is going through, is that decision to stay or go is not a simple one.
Right.
I've had addict clients come to me before and say, why doesn't my spouse just leave me? It would be so much easier if they could just be done with me, because that's what I feel from them, is they want to be done.
Mm-hmm.
But we keep holding on for some reason. And I think in our black and white addict thinking, it's really easy to think that the arithmetic is you're good, I stay, you're bad, I go. But attachment is so much more complicated than right. whether someone's good or bad.
And that's one of the reasons that we advise our clients not to be making those major decisions in at least the first year to 18 months of treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's just so much going on that making major life-altering decisions may not really be something we're capable of doing
yeah.
at that time.
You know, in that brain and body mismatch, and Jackie talked about earlier how there will be a lot of shifting, feeling one way one day and then another extreme another day. That will happen around, we're together, we're working on this, no, I'm leaving, I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think some space to allow that to happen and understand that that comes from a lot of that neurological storm going on. And until that's able to quiet down and your spouse is able to feel safe again,
mm-hmm.
there is going to be a lot of ambivalence around the relationship.
Yeah. I was meeting with a couple last night, and they're doing some separate space right now in order to have some healing and to be able to really understand what's happening individually. And, you know, they brought up, well, what do we do with this? You know, do we say I love you? You know, and he was saying, because mm-hmm. I think that's important for my wife to hear right now. And so I'm telling her every day, I love you. And she was able, you know, she said some days it is what I need and I really like that, but other days it makes me angry.
Yeah.
And again, I think some of it is recognizing that, you know, this has not felt loving. And we have some work to do about what love means, because you've betrayed somebody that you say that you love. And so we really have to take a step back and sometimes, you know, kind of make that, like, let's hold off on some of those terms of endearment
mm-hmm.
or those expressions of love while we work through this, because those can feel very empty and hollow. And we want to be able to at some point reclaim those in the relationship, but we can't really claim it when this kind of damage has just happened.
Well, and in addict rigid thinking, there's going to be, what's my checklist, right? That's going to mm-hmm. make this right. There aren't really rigid checkpoint things that you can do.
Right.
And so, you know, some days it might feel good to do this. Other mm-hmm. days it might not. I think that willingness to check in and willingness to offer what you have to give.
Yeah.
I think some of that, what are you needing from me today?
Mm-hmm.
Question can be really helpful. And
right.
some days the answer is going to be, I need nothing from you. Get away. And as the addict spouse, accept that,
mm-hmm.
give the space, be willing to show up again, and keep working through those issues with support.
Yeah. And I'm thinking of something that Brené Brown talks about where, you know, sometimes our clients want to say to us, like, well, how do I do this? Or what should I say when they say this?
Right.
And, you know, Brené Brown says, rarely does a response make something better.
Yeah.
Like, what makes something better is connection. And so, yeah, we want to be able to have a response that is a Band-Aid or that makes it feel better, instead of sitting in the emotion of where we're at and really understanding that rebuilding this connection is going to take some significant time. And that it's more important rather than the words, because it's not the words that we're going to trust. It's the feeling that we can establish with each other.
Right. What were some of the other areas that we wanted to look at? What did you want to go to next?
Well, I think, you know, talking about some of the things that happens just with the partner, you know, we kind of hit on the attachment trauma that happens and really what intimate betrayal does for the partner. And, you know, we'll see kind of one of two things happen. And I will say, I think overall in our field, a lot of times what's happening with the partner is minimized, and not very many therapists know what to do with that.
Yeah.
And some of that, I think, you know, is maybe part of our own discomfort as therapists or as a society with anger. Mm-hmm. And we want to, we think that the right thing is to get out of anger as quick as possible. And so I think sometimes we have a lot of difficulty or resistance to allowing anger to do what it needs to do. But, you know, I think for partners who have intimately been betrayed, you know, some of them are going to go into what we would call an acute stress state. Mm-hmm. And so symptoms of acute stress include sleeplessness, irritability, an anxiety, tearfulness, not being able to eat. Those kind of things are going to look like acute stress. Now, other partners may have more of what we would term a PTSD response. And for those partners, usually there's also some unresolved underlying trauma that's been there. And now we're adding on another layer of trauma that happens. And so that's where it, you know, it, the acute stress looks more like the PTSD. They still may have some of those acute stress symptoms, but this may also be more of a chronic PTSD situation.
And I would say that that's really where you can feel the difference in acute stress. Like there's kind of a cycle to it, and mm-hmm. there's a coming out of it. In a chronic trauma reaction, is there's not really a coming out of that tunnel.
Right.
The symptoms hang on. The symptoms are more persistent. They may even get more severe as time goes on.
Yeah. And that's, you know, one of the stories that came out of 9/11 here in the United States was, you know, there were groups of journalists on 9/11 there in New York who, as people were running from what was happening, journalists were there and they were snapping pictures. And there was a group of scholars in Boston that started looking at those pictures. And just by looking at the look on people's faces, they were able to say who was going to have PTSD versus who probably was going to be able to be resilient. And it's not that PTSD folks can't be resilient, but they've just got some more layers that they've got to work through.
Right.
And, you know, so one of the things, you know, that we know is, you know, when we have secure attachment, we are more able to regulate ourselves. We are more able to be aware of what's happening to us. So, you know, we may be able to check our heart rate variability. We may understand, you know, and be able to speak to what my heart is doing. Oh, my heart is increasing. We may be able to be able to slow that down. You know, we may be able to, what they would term, you know, keep our wits about us, mm-hmm. which really is kind of this prefrontal cortex, this frontal part of the brain that allows us to think rather than just kind of be in this reacting mode. So we're able to keep our wits about us. And like I said, we're able to kind of notice what's happening to us and then to be able to express that, to be able to tell the story of what happened. You know, we talk sometimes in trauma about how in trauma, we can't really tell the story like beginning, middle, and end.
Right.
Because our brain hasn't made sense of it that way. So it comes in blurbs and it comes in bits and pieces.
Sensations, images,
right.
Emotions. Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, that's just some of what we're able to do if we're able to regulate, you know, and that happens if we have secure attachment. Our nervous system, our central nervous system operates differently when we feel securely attached. And so I think it's really important that, you know, we again underscore, we're talking about intimate betrayal mm-hmm. here. So that really is this intimate attachment wound that has happened.
And I think realizing as the addict in that it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense for your spouse to say, you know, you're the doctor that botched my procedure and I'm really hurting now, fix it. Mm-hmm. And I think that can be something that a lot of addicts and spouses can have a really hard time with, that the secure attachment and the relationships they need to start healing initially are not going to come from their partner.
Right.
They're going to come from sponsors, support people,
therapists,
other people who know kind of what the story is
yeah.
because they've lived that story.
Yeah.
And that can be something I've seen a lot of addicts get really anxious, especially as their spouse starts doing better. Mm-hmm. They get really anxious about the relationship and the attachment. But those those safe, secure relationships outside the marriage in recovery are some of the greatest resilience factors that spouses have in their own recoveries.
And I think it's important, you know, while we're talking about what happens to the spouse with or the partner with intimate betrayal, you know, that doesn't mean that the spouse kind of gets to sit back and say, you did this to me, I am this victim, and this cloud will always hang over your head. Like, I always have this trump card.
Although that's going to be where it starts.
Yes. We see that so often that says, whenever something goes wrong, I'm able to say, well, at least I didn't cheat on you. Well, at least you didn't have to deal with what I had to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not healthy for the spouse either.
Right.
Or for the spouse to just kind of sit back and feel like they're so much better than their partner. Because I would never do these things.
I think that real rebalancing the power in the relationship mm-hmm. is some of the really important work. But there's going to be some really wonky things going on with the power in both areas. Like we see the spouses kind of holding onto that trump card. We also see addicts doing a lot of subversive things to avoid vulnerability or avoid intimacy. And so early on, it's best to get your secure attachment from people who know how to help you. I've heard in Alcoholics Anonymous before, or it is actually an Al-Anon speaker I heard that said, as an Al-Anon, I have to recognize that I can't help an alcoholic. The only person who can help an alcoholic is another alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
And the only person who can help an Al-Anon is another Al-Anon.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think yielding some space for your spouse to connect with other spouses.
Right.
To get some safe support. Nights out with friends and other supportive people might need to be more of a consistent thing, so that there can be some of that safe attachment and letting down some of the defenses and feeling the emotions again.
And hopefully, you know, it's a healthy Al-Anon or S-Anon support group so that they're not just going out and husband bashing or
Absolutely.
Partner bashing, because, again, that's not really productive.
Feeds the resentment rather than helps.
Right. And so that's not going to... I mean, while maybe it feels good that night or even that week, it might feel good that I'm able to just be angry like that. That kind of anger really isn't productive.
Yeah.
So the other thing I think that that we learn from some of the partner 12-step groups starts with kind of in Al-Anon, where Al-Anon really kind of talks about this need to detach with love.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that can be confusing for partners. Yep. How do I do that? What does that even mean? What does that look like? Because detachment itself does not feel loving.
And if I detach, I can't keep an eye on any danger that might be coming my way.
Right. If I detach, I put myself in danger because mm-hmm. I could be betrayed again. I could be blindsided again. And I think for the addicted spouse, it is also difficult because they're going to be recognizing that detachment, and they're also usually primed to start seeing that as not loving.
Yep.
And that they're going to see that as space that is dangerous to the relationship. They're going to see that as, you are moving away from me, and so now I have to kind of get my defenses ready because you're going to leave me.
Well, and one thing that we know about kind of the classic addict profile is that there is a lot of attachment trauma in there. So abandonment is something that a lot of addicts pick up on quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So being able to reframe that and understand that, I think, is a pretty key tool in giving each other the space to heal.
Yeah. So having said that, we wanted to read this quote by Melody Beattie in her book, The Language of Letting Go. She asks this. She says, "When will we become lovable? When will we feel safe? When will we get all the protection, nurturing, and love we so richly deserve? We will get it when we begin giving to ourselves." And I really like that because I think for both the addict and the partner, it's some of the hardest work that you're going to do in recovery. But it's this work of all of a sudden understanding myself and developing this healthy relationship with myself and taking some responsibility for my needs.
And I think in the throes of addiction, that's a difficult thing to do because addicts leave things undone, right?
Mm-hmm.
Addicts live in crisis. And so a lot of times the spouse is playing the role of, I'm just catching everything so that things don't hit the ground.
Right.
And pausing and reframing and saying, I get to put my needs first. And I get to focus on what I'm needing, and I get to attend to that before I attend to anything else. And maybe even saying, you know, if you're letting that drop, maybe it gets to drop.
Mm-hmm.
That's really, really hard work for a spouse to do.
Well, and I think, you know, particularly if the spouse is a female or the partner is a female, I think females are more conditioned to put other people's needs first and put their needs last. And so, you know, that can feel wrong on a lot of various levels. That can be wrong because, you know, my mom said that that's not what females do. Maybe my church said that that's not what females do. Maybe society is saying females can't be angry, you know? And so there's a lot that is going on within the female partner that is really going to push a lot of the social conditioning mm-hmm. that she's grown up in.
Mm-hmm. So some hallmarks, I think, of what we see helps spouses to kind of get connected with that, giving love to themselves and giving compassion mm-hmm. to themselves. This comes from Albert Siebert.
I think that's
how did we decide how you say his name?
I'm going to go with Siebert, but we could not be correct.
He identifies some steps to building resiliency. So this is what it can look like in that process.
And just, you know, just kind of to clarify, resiliency is the ability to rise above difficult circumstances. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're talking about when we're talking about resiliency, is how do we rise again?
And one of the things that I love about the concept of resiliency is we never talk about it as an inborn trait.
Right.
There's factors there. And so when he talks about steps for building resiliency, these are things that people can learn.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't do this now, you can learn how to do mm-hmm. it. So some points that he gives is optimize your emotional stability, health, and well-being. We've noticed that simple focus on like diet, exercise, and sleep can go a really long way in stabilizing emotion.
Right. I mean, and that may be where you have to pare back a lot of stuff, you know, like maybe you typically volunteer in your kid's school class and for a year, you're not able to do that.
Yeah.
And you don't like that. But again, this is able to look at where is my emotional stability? Where is my health? And making that a priority is part of being resilient.
Yeah. Another point, he says, focus outward and develop good problem-solving skills. I love the concept of skill power, not willpower.
Mm-hmm.
I think most of the time we try to greet our really difficult circumstances with willpower. I'll grit my way through this.
Right.
And that makes me think of, you know, kind of how I learned how to solve complex problems was just you go at it, you go at it, you go at it until it's solved.
Right.
As I become an adult and more conscious of my limited energy stores, I'm a lot more concerned about what's the best approach to this. And I tend to spend more time in research and learning before I approach a problem mm-hmm. or something that I need to do because it tends to work a little more smoothly when I'm coming from a place of skill.
Well, I think it also takes into consideration that simply getting through is not the goal,
right?
I don't just need to get through this difficult thing, but I really, you know, that part about focusing outward, like I really need to be able to notice certain things that are happening in my external world. And then I need to develop problem solving skills. So how I get through this is just as important, maybe even more important than just getting through this.
Right, which is a big change again in trauma thinking. We're in survival mode, which is just
right.
just live another day, just live
just
another
survive.
Day. And we're really working on building stability and building stability that you can count on
mm-hmm.
here. The other side of that coin is focusing inward and developing a strong inner gatekeeper that includes self-confidence, self-esteem, and self-concept. I think work on understanding what we think about what we feel and
yep.
what we think about what we think.
Mm-hmm.
And just that ability to determine what kind of energy we're letting in and what kind of energy we're letting out and really checking in on, are we okay with that interchange? Did we consent to that interchange or is it just mm-hmm. happening?
Well, and again, if we're in extreme thinking, this is going to throw you a little bit here because we just said to focus outward. Now we're saying focus inward. And, you know, it may be that feeling of like, well, wait, which is it? Which is more important? And as we talk about, there's a lot of paradoxes in recovery mm-hmm. and you can't just do one. You can't, you know, so it is about focusing outward and noticing what is happening in your external world. And then noticing what's happening inwardly, like how does that make me feel? What is happening in my body as I'm noticing that? And that really, You know, I like to think of self-esteem as really kind of this knowing of the self.
Yeah.
And if I don't know what's happening internally and I can't like verbalize that to myself, I can't really even see that that's happening or feel that that's happening to me. I don't have a lot of self-knowledge. Mm-hmm. And that's really a part of building self-esteem, is really knowing who I am and what all that means.
And we do that because it's difficult to bring the appropriate skills to bear when we don't really have an accurate concept of what's happening for
mm-hmm.
us.
Mm-hmm.
The next one is develop some resiliency skills. And like we've said before, one of the biggest factors of resiliency is connected relationships.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where a lot of people get the most bang for their buck is... you don't have to have, you know, 15 connected, safe relationships. Sometimes it just takes one.
Mm-hmm.
Or it takes a group of people that you go to regularly, mm-hmm. and you know that it's a safe space. You know that that's a place where you can let down your guard and you can be cared for. You can
right.
be helped there.
And another, I think, important resiliency skill is looking at and saying, okay, I'm in a really difficult spot right now. But also kind of looking at that in terms of, this is temporary. I'm not mm-hmm. going to feel this way for the next 10 years of my life. I may be feeling this way for the next 2 or 3 years of my life on varying levels, right? I'm not always going to feel the way that I feel the first year after discovery. But also knowing that, like, gradually I'm going to walk myself out of this to a new way of living. And I will have joy again. I will be able to, you know, laugh or sing or whatever it is that we're stopping doing right now because it's so heavy. So being able to look at and say, this is where I am right now, but it's not always going to stay this way.
Yeah. The last point that he talks about in here is developing your talent for serendipity. I'm embarrassed to admit here, serendipity is a word that I know, but I don't think I can operationally define it.
Okay, look on your phone for the okay. definition of serendipity.
Here we come.
But I think also what he's getting at here is, you know, because we don't want to just become really rigid in our recovery. We want to be able to move. We want to be able to adapt. Do you got it? It
says, serendipity is the occurrence and development of events by chance in a happy and beneficial way. So this makes total sense to me. I wouldn't use that word.
Okay.
I think it's Carnes talks about being willing to let your recovery become something that you didn't expect it to be.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's that taking lemons and turning them into lemonade.
Yeah.
Whatever comes up, I can find a benefit here. Mm-hmm. I can find a use here. And I think when we have that kind of attitude that says nothing is wasted,
yep.
all things can go for my growth, we tend to be much more resilient than the right things have to happen in the right order mm-hmm. or else I'm sunk.
Right. Right. And I think, again, that's allowing us, right? Because I think sometimes in a trauma response, we do tend to get a little bit tense and rigid in our body.
Mm-hmm.
And so being able to, as this talks about, discover your talent for serendipity, again, this gets us moving again.
Yep.
This gets us flowing.
Creative.
Yes. It gets us more in kind of a fluidity where I can move with what's happening. Another person, Martin Seligman, that we talk about, or did I say his last name wrong?
I think there's like 5 ways to
okay.
pronounce it.
And he was what was his position with the APA? What do you call it?
The chair.
The chair, the director, the president, whatever. I don't know what the official title is, but he was the chair of the American Psychiatric Association. And when he took over, he kind of said, I want to really understand strengths. And, you know, while we work a lot with our clients on their deficits, if we are also not helping them discover and develop their strengths, we are doing a disservice to them.
Yeah.
And so this is where you started seeing a lot of positive psychology coming about, which I think is absolutely great. And so, you know, this goes along really well with resiliency. You know, can I know what my strengths are, and will my strengths surface at some of my darkest moments?
Yeah.
Not in order so that I don't have to feel my dark moments, but will my strengths actually kind of help pull me through? Will I be able to say, wow, I will get to this place again? And so, you know, he talks about just developing some strengths kind of as qualities that each of us naturally possess. We all have intrinsic strengths within us that, you know, they may include feelings of joy or excitement or zest, he talks about. And, you know, he says, when we're talking about these strengths, it's statements such as kind of, this is the real me. This is who I am. And I think, you know, when we go through trauma, we a lot of times lose connection with that person. And so being able to remember that, now for some people, maybe they really haven't ever developed that fully. And so that's pretty tenuous already. You know, knowing who I am is already kind of like, I don't really know. I'm a mom, I'm a wife. And now all of that got turned upside down. What does that mean? And so again, some of the work, you know, that the partner is going to have to do are things, you know, answering questions like, what makes your life worth living? And again, I talk to clients about, this isn't just the roles that you play, you know, because the various roles that we play have a lot to do, how those look, you know, how I am as a mom really says a lot about who I am as a person.
Yeah.
And that's going to look different for my neighbor. That's going to look different for my sister. And so knowing, you know, the reason I do this is because this is my personality or this is my strength. And so that's okay to do that. It doesn't look exactly like my neighbor or my sister or my friend, but that's okay. They're different than me. So again, what is it that lights fire in your soul? What makes you chuckle? What makes you laugh? What brings passion into your existence? You know, are you using your strengths on a day-to-day experience? And how can you begin shifting your focus to create a life filled with abundance rather than scarcity, with gratitude and authentic happiness, even when you're faced with uncertainty, even when you're in some really dark places, which you will be? How can you, you know, kind of hold both of these existences, these my strengths as well as my darkness? How can I hold both of those and honor both of those?
I loved when we went to financial and work disorder training, and mm-hmm. the trainer had said that our strengths are like the next door neighbors to our traumas.
Mm, yes.
And I love that concept of that's how we hold it. We recognize that those grew out of the same mm-hmm. seed.
Mm-hmm.
And that when we bring our strengths to bear, it's not some Pollyanna, everything's fine. It's actually very directly addressing and correcting some of the hurts that have happened.
Yeah.
So we're going to pause there for today. We will be back next week with our episode on useful information for spouses to know about their addict.
Thanks. At the end of another episode, we want to remind you that nobody has time for perfection. We are pursuing progress.
Remember the prayer of the perfectionist. Help me remember, I can't do it all. Help me to take things one step at a time, and that the only step I need to focus on is the next right step for me. Help me to remember that life is a journey. Help me to be able to separate all that I am learning from all that I have to do. Help me to remember that I am not alone, that I can ask for help. Help me to strive for frequent awakenings, not mastery. I am enough. Amen.
You can find more Thanks for Sharing at www.thanksforsharingpodcast.com or on Facebook and Instagram at Thanks for Sharing Podcast.
Disclaimer, this podcast is solely for the purpose of information and entertainment and does not constitute therapy, nor should it replace competent professional help.